We are in Maseches Rosh Hashanah and Daf Chav Ches Amud Beis, where the Gemara has a whole discussion about the sugya of mitzvos tzrichos kavana or mitzvos ein tzrichos kavana. Now here, right in the middle of that discussion, the Gemara has a very important sugya, which is all about Bal Tosif and Bal Tigra. And that's what we're going to talk about tonight, because it's a very, very important Gemara that has a lot of very fundamental underpinnings with other ideas and shas as well. So the whole sugya of Bal Tosif and Bal Tigra begins with a pasuk in Parshas Va'eschanan. In fact, it's quoted twice in Chumash, the Yisra Bal Tosif and Bal Tigra. The first time is in Parshas Va'eschanan, where the pasuk says, Lo sosifu al hadavar asher anochi mitzavcha eschem hayom, v'lo sigru mimenu. And then once again, it's quoted in Parshas Re'eh, but there it says, Eis kol hadavar asher anochi mitzavcha eschem hayom, lo sosif alav, v'lo sigra mimenu. So here it's b'lashon yachid, whereas in Parshas Va'eschanan, it's b'lashon rabim. And this is a major question. Number one, why do we need the Torah to emphasize this Isser of Bal Tosif and Bal Tigra twice? And number two, why is it B'lashon Yachid once and B'lashon Rabim the second time? So the Vilna Gaon points out that really we're addressing two different scenarios here. One is talking about a person where, let's say, Chazal are Mosif on the minion of Taryag Mitzvahs. We have an assumption that there are 630 Mitzvahs. That's the assumption that we all run by. That's the assumption that all the Moni HaMitzvahs, or most of the Moni HaMitzvahs, assume. But that's not such a simple assumption. The Ramban himself in the Sefer HaMitzvahs questions whether or not there really are 613 mitzvahs. He said, who came up with this number? Just because the Gemara has an Agadita that says, Taryag 613, who said that that's halacha l'maisa? But either way, that's the way we understand, that's the way we assume, that there are in fact 613 mitzvahs. So says the Vilna Gaon, if Chazal will come along and say later on that Ner Chanukah is a mitzvah d'oraisa, that would be a violation of lo sosifu. That would be a violation of adding on to the Taryag Mitzvahs. If they come along and say this is a Din D'Rabbanan, it's one thing. But if they're going to put it and tack it in as a Din D'Oraisa, that's going to be a violation of Bal Tosif on the communal level. But then you have somebody individually who chooses also to be Mosif onto a mitzvah. For example, the Vilna Gaon points out, if a person decides to have five corners on the tzitzis, or a person decides to take five minim in the lulav and asrug, or a person decides to add on in various different ways, or a person decides only to have three corners and to put on tzitzis on that, that would be a individual violation of Bal Tigra, or an individual violation of Bal Tosif. And here the Vilna Gaon points out, this is why we have to have two separate halachas, one teaching me for the klal, and one teaching me for the yachid. Each one is a very individual halacha, and each one teaches me something else. There's a famous mashal of the Dubna Magid. The Dubna Magid is known for a lot of his mashalim, but the Dubna Magid gives two mashalim about how we understand the Isra of Bal Tosif and Bal Tigra. So he says that there are two different ways that you can look at items in this world. There are some items that are very simple, very uncomplicated. It's just a piece of mass, a piece of matter, something in its entirety, no work done to it, nothing complicated at all. So he says, let's say you take, for example, a bar of silver or a bar of gold, anything of that nature. Nothing major was done to it, just it is what it is. So he says, the larger the bar of silver or the bar of gold, the more expensive it is. That everybody understands, everybody knows that. The larger the piece of wood, the more expensive it's going to be, even though there was no work done to it. However, he says, you have a second category of items in the world that are very complicated, very complex. They're made up of many different elements, many different components, and many different parts. And therefore, he says, the more intricate it is, the more expensive it's going to be. Let's say you buy a car, and you say, oh, had the tire been twice the size, it would have cost twice as much. It's not true. Had the tire been twice the size, it would have been totally destroyed. You wouldn't have been able to drive the car. Why? Because it wouldn't fit into the whole picture of what you're trying to manufacture, what you're trying to sell. That's not the function of the tire when you have a complicated system made up of many different elements, many different parts. When you have something that's just very simple by itself, the bigger it is, the more expensive it is, the more value it has. When you have something that's made up of a conglomerate of many different elements, then we assume everything has to be exactly the way it is. If it's 1 inch smaller, 1 inch bigger, it's going to ruin the whole picture. And that's what he says as well with regard to the Torah. From the fact that the Ribbono Shel Olam made a very complicated Torah that is made of Taryag Mitzvahs that have so many different ancillary parts of it as well, if you're going to be Mosif or Megareya, that's like taking a car and making the tire twice the size. The car is not going to function. If you have a car with windshield wipers that are too big for the window, it's not going to be able to wash the window. It's not going to work. So too over here, he says, that's the way to understand why the Ribbono Shel Olam said there's an Isra of Bal Tosif or Bal Tigra. It's not because we don't want your contribution, but rather because you don't understand the complexity of the entirety of the system. If only you understood it, you would realize why taking five minim in the lulav is not really going to enhance the mitzvah, it's going to take away from the whole picture of what Torah is supposed to be. And if you take away, if you only have three corners on the tzitzis, that also is going to take away from the beautiful whole of what the Torah, what the finished product is supposed to look like. That's the way the Dubna Magid explains. He has another mashal somewhere else where he explains it a little differently. Beautiful mashal, but it's a little bit funny. But he says about somebody who, two neighbors who were very friendly, and one neighbor was pretty wealthy and one neighbor was pretty poor. So the poor neighbor goes to his other neighbor who's much wealthier, and he says, you know, I ran out of spoons today. Would you mind if I borrowed your spoon? He says, sure. He gives him a spoon. The next day he comes back to me, he returns two spoons. He says, what happened? Why are you giving me back two spoons? He says, well, the spoon had a baby, so I'm giving both. Comes back the next day, he says, I would like to borrow a fork. He says, sure. He gives him a fork. Next day he comes to return, and he gives him back two forks. He says, what's going on here? Why are you giving me two? He says, oh, last night it gave birth. It had, you know, another fork, so I'm giving back both of them. And the same thing happens day in, day out, until finally the wealthy neighbor says, I better start giving him all my fancy stuff, because, look, he's, you know, everything's going to have children, and then he's going to give me back more. After a while, the poor man goes to his neighbor. He says, you know, I'm having a big party in my house tonight. I would like to borrow your big silver candelabra in your house, and I would like to use it for the party to have my guests enjoy a little bit more than they usually would in my house. He says, sure, you know, he was more than happy to give it to him. Look what's going to happen. I'm going to give him my candelabra. The next day he comes to him, he says, well, would you like to return my candelabra? He says, no, it died. He says, what do you mean it died? He says, why are you so surprised that it died? If you weren't surprised when I said that your other items gave birth, why is it so surprising that this one died? So that's what the Dubna Magid writes. It's just as ludicrous to say that it died as it is to say it had a baby, and that's the same. If you're going to take away from the Torah, you understand that that's ridiculous. You're going to say it died. The mitzvah doesn't apply anymore. That's crazy. That's like saying the candelabra died. Well, that's going to lead you ultimately also to say, well, it grew. It had a baby. That's just as silly as saying that it died. And therefore, he says, that's why the system was set up, that Baltosev and Baltigra both apply. You're not allowed to add. You're not allowed to subtract, because it's going to lead you to all these silly kind of ideas of how you think the Torah should look and how you think the Torah should be observed, when meanwhile you're just as foolish as that neighbor who's giving the extra item or taking away the item because he says that the silver candelabra passed away. Yeah.
Where do we draw the line in allowing Chazal to involve?
So that's a very, very serious question. Where do we draw the line in terms of what right Chazal have to add mitzvahs and what right they have not to? So the Rambam writes very clearly, there's a machlokes the Rambam and the Ravid, exactly how do you understand what the role of Chazal is in instituting new mitzvahs. And that's why, when it comes to Purim, this is a very big question. What right did they have to make Purim and Hanukkah? What right did they have to institute all these halachos? That's a very, very serious question that's discussed in the Achronim, what the justification was for them doing that. And that's why the Gemara itself discusses it. Try to figure out why it is that those were permissible. Basically, the understanding of the Rambam is, as long as they're clear and they say, this is a din d'rabbanan, and they don't try to fool us and make pretend as if we're going to pass it off as a din d'oraisa, then we're allowed to accept that as a real takana d'rabbanan. Look, the Chazal have the right to say lo sasser. They have a right to make new takanas, new gzeiras, new things that are instituted. The reason why Purim and Chanukah are a little bit different is because a gzeira and a takana of Chazal makes sense, because usually they do that to set you up to make sure that you're not going to violate something else. Let's say, Muktzan Shabbos, they said, you're not allowed to carry this item or that item because we don't want to lead to carrying something outside and violating an issa d'oraisa. That makes sense. That's a harchaka. But the question by Hanukkah and Purim is, what's the harchaka there? What's that an extension of? It's not an extension of anything. And that's why we have a much more difficult question when it comes to those particular issues of Purim and Hanukkah, that doesn't seem to be a harchaka, doesn't seem to be an exera, doesn't seem to be any sort of extension of any other halacha. So that's something maybe we'll reserve for Purim and Hanukkah time. It's a very important issue. Comes up as well by Yom HaTzmud. For those who believe that Yom HaTzmud is something significant, again, not everybody does, but if you're of that train of thought, so what right do we have to make new days of celebration? It's very nice that you have something you want to commemorate, but to go ahead and say Halal, or to go ahead and have a real celebration with Dov Tachnun, who said he had a right to do that? Maybe that's just as wrong as making something in commemoration of Hanukkah and Purim, and just because it's justified over there, who said it's justified over here? So you have to figure out how to put that all into the proper context. In any event, our Gemara here has a very famous brisa that is quoted, I'm sorry, a Mishnah from Maseches Zvachim Daf Pei. The Mishnah here is brought in the first wide line, and here we're talking about the following case. First wide line of Chav Ches Amud Beis, the Mishnah tells us from Zvachim, Hanitanin b'matana achas. Let's say you have some karbanos have to be sprinkled one time on the Mizbeach, some karbanos have to be sprinkled four times on the Mizbeach. So the Mishnah says, what happens when you have a dilemma as follows. Hanitanin b'matana achas. Let's say I come to the Beis HaMikdash, I'm offering my carbon Pesach. Happens to be there are a million other people who are also offering a carbon Pesach. It's Erev Pesach. We all have to do the same thing. So all the carbon Pesach have to be sprinkled one time on the Mizbeach. So here I am. I give the kohen my carbon. He has the blood. And now, Nis'arvu b'nitanim b'matana achas. Now my blood that needs to be sprinkled once on the Mizbeach gets mixed up with somebody else's blood that needs to be spilled once on the Mizbeach. And now they're all together in one big pot. And now the kohen comes and he doesn't know, what am I supposed to do? Pesach with Pesach. We each have to sprinkle one. So what should he do? Should he do one for you and one for me? Or should he do one and assume that's going to count for both? So the Gemara says, in such a case, no problem at all. Once the two pools of blood get mixed together, we assume that they're going to get mixed together enough that if he's going to take one sprinkling, that's going to count for both of us. And there's no reason to take two separate ones. One is going to suffice. And the same goes, let's say I violate an Avera. And now I have to go to the Beis HaMikdash and bring a carbon chatas. And a carbon chatas, as we know, has to be sprinkled four times on the Mizbeach. So let's say I did an Avera. If you can imagine, somebody else also would do an Avera. Hard to imagine. So you have both of us come to the Beis HaMikdash. We both have to bring a carbon chatas. And now my blood from my chatas gets mixed up with your blood from your chatas. And now the kohen doesn't know what to do. What should he do when he comes to the Mizbeach? How many times should he sprinkle it? Should he do four times for you, four times for me? Is that going to be good enough? The Mishnah says yes. Because four times the blood is liquidy, it's very viscous, and we assume that since it's going to be all mixed together, we assume that four times is going to really suffice for both our karbanos. However, here's where you have a dilemma. Here's where you have a problem. What if you have my karban chatos gets mixed up with your karban Pesach? So your karban has to be sprinkled only once. My karban has to be sprinkled four times. So now what do you do? So the kohen is stuck. If he sprinkles it four times, so now he's violating Baal Tosef on my carbon Pesach that was supposed to only be sprinkled once. If he only sprinkles it one time, he's violating Baal Tigra on your carbon Chatas that was supposed to be sprinkled four times. So this is what the Gemara says. That's a halachic dilemma. That's a real problem. Because either way, whatever he's going to do is going to be a problem. So here the Gemara has a machlokas between Rabbi Lezer and Rabbi Yeshua. Rabbi Lezer is of the opinion that maybe you should do Baal Tosef. Rabbi Yeshua is of the opinion, well, Baal Tigra. And the Gemara has this problem. Which one is better? Should you violate Baal Tosef by sprinkling it four times? Or should you violate Baal Tigra by sprinkling it only one time? So the Turi Evan asks on our Gemara, I don't understand. How come there's no third option? Shouldn't there be a third option of? Abstain. Don't do anything. Shave Al Tasa. Right? Don't do anything, then you won't violate Baal Tigra, you won't violate Baal Tosef. You're just not doing anything. You're mevatel mitzvah haseh, but you're not going to do anything. So the Turi Evan of Rosh Hashanah has an assumption. His assumption is, by asking that question, what's the assumption, what's the premise? That if you just abstain and not do anything, you wouldn't violate Baal Tigra. You would just be mevatel haseh of Zrikas Hadam, correct? Otherwise, what's his question? So the question is obviously assuming that if a person would just abstain and do nothing in such a scenario, he would not violate Baal Tigra. That's his question, and that is not a simple assumption at all. Rabbeinu Yonah writes in the Shari Tshuva very clearly, if a person has the ability to perform a mitzvah saseh, for example, I have the ability to blow shofar, and I choose not to blow shofar, not that I'm sick in the hospital and I'm not able to, that's an onus. But what if you have somebody who chooses, I'm not going to go to shul today, I'm not going to do this mitzvah, I'm not going to put on tefillin today. So we know that you're in violation of being mevatel mitzvah haseh, but Rabbeinu Yonah writes you're also in violation of the iser of Baal Tigra, because you have the opportunity to perform a mitzvah, and you're choosing to opt out of it. So not only are you being mevatel mitzvah haseh, you're also in violation of Baal Tigra. That's the chiddush of the Shari Tshuva of Rabbeinu Yonah. Other Rishonim write that as well. And basically that's against this whole assumption of the Turi Evan. One second, yeah? So that's a good question. No, so the halacha is if you don't do the zrika, let's say all the blood spills on the floor, you don't do anything. So you don't have the opportunity to fulfill the mitzvah of zrika sadam, but the carbon is still a carbon. Well, it's a question of whether you count it as a separate mitzvah. That's the Rambam has a discussion about that. Maybe it should all be subsumed under one mitzvah. But either way, we assume it's certainly a separate chelik of the mitzvah. And right, correct. Correct. That's correct, yeah.
If he doesn't do anything, right, so he's not fulfilling any, so How's that about tigra? It's like you didn't do any mitzvah.
Ah.
If you would have done it, then it's already, you have to do something to get bal tigra.
So this is a very, very big machlokas harishonim. How do we define bal tigra? This is a three-way machlokas harishonim, which again, Rabbeinu Yonah is weighing in on. How do you define bal tigra? I would have said bal tigra means when I'm performing a mitzvah, but I choose not to do it in the proper way, that's bal tigra. Over here, the Shaar HaTshuva of Rabbeinu Yonah is saying, no, even if I choose not to do the mitzvah at all, that's also bal tigra, which is a big chiddush. Let's begin like this. Tosas asking Rosh Hashanah, both in our Gemara as well as in Daf Tazayin, Tosas asked the same question. How were the Chacham allowed to come along and say you should blow 100 kolos on Rosh Hashanah? That's not what you're obligated to do. We know those are only the Rabbanan. So isn't that bal tosif? They're adding on to the mitzvah on Rosh Hashanah of blowing shofar. So what right do you have to add on to the mitzvah? Isn't that a blatant violation of bal tosif? It's an issur d'oraisa. That's Tosas kasha. Tosas answered the kasha by saying, there's no issur of bal tosif when you do a mitzvah twice. So today, for example, tomorrow morning I decide I had such a great time wearing my tefillin, I'm going to put them on again in the afternoon. That's not bal tosif. It might be crazy, but there's nothing wrong with that. But take, for example, you have a Kohen who goes up, he duchens by a minion, now they ask him to duchen by a second minion. Is that bal tosif? Tosif says no. Why not? Because he's just doing the same mitzvah twice. That's not bal tosif at all. Again, he might not want to do it. It's a pain in the neck. He's going to have to go, let's say, in the shtiblach in Yerushalayim. So you're going to have to go every minion. You'll be stuck there the whole day. So you might not want to do it. But to do that more than once is not a violation of bal tosif. However, Tosif says, what if I decide to add on a fifth min to the lulav? That would be a violation of bal tosif. Or if I decide to take away one of the minim in the lulav, that would be a violation of bal tigra. Okay? So that's Tosas' understanding of what the definition of bal tosif and bal tigra actually are. The Rashba disagrees. The Rashba in Rosh Hashanah, earlier on in Daf Tazayin, where Tosas asked the question the first time, not here. So the Rashba answers the question differently. He says, no. The reason why bal tosif wouldn't be an issue there by blowing the 100 kolos on Rosh Hashanah is because the Chachamim said that's the way you're supposed to do it. When are you in violation of bal tosif or bal tigra? It's when you decide on your own that this is the way I should perform the mitzvah. Then you're in violation of bal tosif and bal tigra. So somebody gets up one day and decides, you know what? I only want to wear tefillin shel-yad, not the tefillin shel-rosh. I only want to shake three minim in the lulav, not four. There, says the Rashba, you'd be in violation of bal tosif or bal tigra. However, if the Chachamim come along and tell you how you should perform the mitzvah, or how not to perform the mitzvah. For example, on Rosh Hashanah Shechalias B'Shabbos, Chazal come along and say, don't blow the shofar. There, says the Rashba, you would not be in violation of Bal Tigra. The Vilna Gaon. So the Vilna Gaon, again, the Vilna Gaon tried to learn in the Psukim that that's the way you understand the two Psukim. Again, the Rashba is obviously going to have to learn the Psukim a little bit differently. The problem is that Rashi on Chumash writes yet another definition. So this is very, very complicated. How do you define in the first place what exactly bal tosif and bal tigra really are? It's worthy of pointing out that based on the Rashba we just mentioned in the beginning of Maseches Rosh Hashanah, the Mishnah Berurah quotes that la'alacha, and the Mishnah Berurah writes that based on that, you can extrapolate as well. If a person has an opportunity, which is a frightening Mishnah Berurah, a person has an opportunity to perform a mitzvah in a lichatchila way, and you choose to do it in a b'dievet fashion, again, we're not talking about somebody who can't afford it. We're talking about somebody who has the opportunity to perform a mitzvah in a lechatchila way, and you choose to do it only b'di'eved, the Mishnah Berurah writes you're in violation of the Isser of Bal Tigra for doing so, for choosing to perform a mitzvah in such a way, when you have the opportunity to do it in the most pristine fashion, and you choose to dumb it down, choose to do it in a way which is not as beautiful as you could have. In such a way, the Mishnah Berurah writes, you'd be in violation of Bal Tigra. How does the Mishnah Berurah know that? He proves it from our Gemara. Our Gemara says here that we have a disagreement in the Tanoim. Should you go ahead and sprinkle the dam that gets mixed up? One carbon has to be sprinkled four times. One carbon has to be sprinkled once. The Gemara has an option. Maybe you should sprinkle once. Maybe you should sprinkle four times. We're not sure. Should you violate Bal Tosif or Bal Tigra? So the assumption of the Gemara is if you only sprinkle once, you'll be in violation of Bal Tigra. Right? Because you should have done four times. Correct? So you'll be in violation of Bal Tigra. Points out to Mishnah Berurah, don't you know, I mean, I didn't know this, but he says, the Gemara says in Zvachim, could be everybody else does, that b'di'eved, if you do a Zrikas Adam one time on a carbon that you're supposed to do it for, b'di'eved yotzei the mitzvah, says the Mishnah Berurah. So what do you see? What do you see? You see that even though, if you did it once, You could have done your mitzvah, and b'diavad your yotze the mitzvah for both karbanos. Still, the Gemara calls that bal tigra. Says the Mishnah Berurah, don't you learn from there that if a person chooses to perform a mitzvah in a b'diavad fashion instead of doing the lechatchila way of doing it, you're in violation of bal tigra? Unbelievable! It's an unbelievable chiddush. That's what my father learns from there. That nowadays that we have a possibility to wear tcheles. So again, if you feel that the tcheles is not in the cards, it's not an option. So then it's out of the picture. But if you believe it's at least a subject. So again, let's say you live in a generation where we knew for sure that the tcheles was the right tcheles. Right? And a person chooses not to wear the tcheles, you only wear the white. So you're in fulfillment of your mitzvah, b'diavad. L'chatchila, you're supposed to wear it with the tcheles. B'diavad yotze, even if you have only white. So now that we live in a generation where you have the opportunity to perhaps perform the mitzvah l'chatchila, and you choose not to, so again, if you don't have money to pay for the tcheles, that's one story. But if you do have money for everything else and you're just choosing to be cheap on the tcheles and you're choosing not to perform the mitzvah lechatchila, you're only performing it b'diavad, that's exactly what the Mishnah Berurah says, that you're in violation of not only being mevatel the mitzvah saseh of tcheles, but also of the isra of baltigra, because you had an opportunity to do a mitzvah lechatchila, you're choosing to do it b'diavad, that's exactly the shaila. Again, if you assume that the tcheles isn't even a suffix nowadays, it's not even in the cards, then this discussion is not for you. But if you feel that it is something to talk about, it is something to discuss, then there is a major point to argue based on this Mishnah Berurah that there is a very important reason to wear it, not only because maybe you're going to be in fulfillment of a mitzvah saseh, but also because perhaps you'll be in violation of a lo saseh of baltigra. Another very important point that comes out of this Gemara of the whole issue, this dilemma that we have of what are you supposed to do when you have all the blood that gets mixed up together, the four with the one, and how should you deal with how should you reconcile such a situation? That's a very important issue because of the following. My father always likes to point out that you see from this Gemara a very important principle in halacha. Very often when we are faced with a dilemma, it will be a halachic dilemma or something else, we feel the right answer is Shev Al Tasa. The right answer is Shev Al Tasa. So if you have an option here in our Gemara of either sprinkling one time and violating Bal Tigra b'Shev Al Tasa, or sprinkling four times and violating Bal Tosef b'Kum Va'aseh, what would you have said, logically? Now nobody knows the right answer. But I would have said, violate Bal Tigra b'Shev Al Tasa, because at least I'm not actively doing anything wrong. But you see that the Gemara is questioning that assumption. You see that the Gemara has a disagreement here, which option is more preferable? Which is the preferred option? Is it better that you go and sprinkle it four times, even though that means b'adayim you're going to violate an avera of baltosif? Or is it better to sprinkle it one time where b'shev al tasa you'll violate baltigra? That's not clear. The Gemara has a disagreement about that, and each one brings a svara, but it's not clear. The answer is not so clear-cut that we say, well, shev al tasa adiv. Not to violate an avera b'adayim is always the thing that we're looking for. That's always what we want. That's always the desired outcome. That's the result. So that's why I should have said that, but that's not what the Gemara says.
Even if you did it once, you'd be right?
If you did it once, yeah.
If you did nothing, or you did it once, right. You'd be both cases.
Right.
So both cases, the only choice that you would ever do not be the is by doing it four.
Right, but why would you do it for? Why does the Gemara take that as an option?
I told you something that you should, if you do the same corner four times, it's not both cases.
Okay.
But if you were to put it in another corner, let's say you spend on two corners, then you're about to.
Okay.
What's the
what do you mean? Either way, if you do it four here, the Gemara is talking about doing it four, and the Gemara gives that as an option in a way that you will violate Bal Tosef, means you're going to sprinkle it on the two corners. So why would that even be in the option? That shouldn't be an option at all. Option one should be, don't sprinkle at all, don't do anything. Option number two should be, sprinkle it one time. Why do we have an option three? Why is there an option three to go ahead and sprinkle the blood? Biyadayim, you're violating an Isser Biyadayim, you're actively going ahead and doing something that you're not supposed to do. Isn't that the worst option? Why does the Gemara even bring that into the discussion? And from here you see clearly that when you have a halachic dilemma, the answer is not always Shev Al Tasa Adif. The answer is you have to size up the situation, you have to make a very careful analysis and assessment as to what is the least of all the evils involved in what I'm about to do. So that's exactly what they're disagreeing about. And each one brings a svar. Maybe violating Biyadayim is less chamer than the Isra of Bal Tigra. That's exactly the disagreement. But the answer is not always Shev Al Tasa Adif. For example, take for example. Yeah?
How is Bal Tigra here not in violating Biyadayim? I'm still only doing it one time instead of doing it four times.
Because each one of them needs to be done once for sure.
This one needs to be done, especially if you go with this lechatchila being
right.
A problem of being a problem of Libra. I'm not doing it. I'm stopped. I go and I do it once and I say, this is enough for this problem, but it isn't. So I did that for your dying. It's not like, if I sit here on my hands, I've got to share about that.
Right.
Once I do it and I do it wrong, and I decide to
so you're saying wrong, you would prefer option.
No, I'm just saying that's just as being a dying and doing it four times or something that doesn't want. Because I have to actively do the wrong amount.
So you're saying you're doing something. So you certainly would never have said to do all four, right? You would have chosen option A, which is not mentioned in the Gemara.
Once you're deciding, I'm not differentiating between the doing more or doing less as being better or worse. Once you're deciding to do the wrong number, once you're deciding,
you're saying that's already a violation be a dying.
It's a violation be a dying. Whether you're doing the wrong number less, so it's or you're doing the wrong number more, where it's baltosif,
mm-hmm.
You're doing sheva al pasas. The only way to do sheva al pasas is not do anything. In which case, then there's just whether that's baltosif or not.
Right, but again, but why didn't the Gemara give that option? The Gemara should have either chosen do nothing,
like the
Turiya,
but he holds that it's like baltosif, so it's no.
It still is better because you're not doing anything via dime. According to your logic, you're not doing anything via dime in that case. So either you should have said option A, which is the Turi Evan, don't do anything, or you should give option B of doing one, or you should leave out option C. Why do we give option C at all of doing all four? And what you see is the Gemara is grappling with the issue of how do we figure out what's the Bechira B'miyad Hara. It's not so clear. It's not so clear. And what we try to do in a halachic dilemma is figure out what is going to bring about the least possible damage, not figuring out how am I going to do the least activity. We're trying to figure out what is going to do the least possible damage, and that's why the Gemara here is very unclear. Again, the story, this was Rav Shach's point that he made from the Gemara. It's a very important point. Rav Shach, many years ago, when the Medina was started, so the Aguda originally was out of all the politics. They didn't want to get involved at all. And Rav Shach at some point, I don't know when it happened, but Rav Shach at some point decided that he felt it was time that the Torah community gets involved in the government, because whether the government's going to do the right thing or the wrong thing, we're not going to influence them, but at least we'll be able to influence a decision that will help our community a little bit. At least we'll be able to bring about some sort of good. So Rav Shach came along and he said that that's what they're going to do, and he wants that all the Torah Jewry should follow behind him to be a part of the next government. There was some young Rav at the time. My father said it was Rav Moshe Sternbuch, but Rav Asher Weiss told me recently that he remembered it differently. It wasn't Rav Moshe Sternbuch. Either way, it was somebody who was a big kanoi at the time and got up and attacked Rav Shach for the decision that he made to join the Israeli government. What right do you have? A bunch of Rishayim, a bunch of atheists, you're not allowed to join them. So this was a whole big deal. So my father was younger at the time, and he said that Rav Shach felt that it was beneath him to write a response to this young kanoi who wrote him the letter. So he decided to write an open letter to all the yeshivas, and he sent it as a fax to all the different yeshivas all over the world, that they should hang it up, that everybody should understand Rav Shach's position, not in direct response to this question, but basically to explain his position. And he said that, yes, you're arguing that I shouldn't get involved at all because Sheval Tasa Adif, but you're incorrect, because we have a Gemara here where the Gemara tells us clearly that when you have a halachic dilemma, the answer is not always Shev Al Tasa. You have to make an assessment, you have to make an evaluation. What is the lesser of the two evils? I made an assessment, says Rav Shach, that although I really should not be joining forces with them because I don't agree with everything they're doing, but the lesser of the two evils at this point in history is that we should join them. Even though it means violating the Aveira, so to speak, Bekumva Asay, even though it means joining the government that we shouldn't be joining, and even though it means coming along with them, even though we don't agree with them, but still, violating that, so to speak, Aveira, Bekumva Asay, is greater than the Sheva Tasa right now. And that's where Rav Shach said, you see from our Gemara, that it's not always, the answer is not always Sheva Tasa Adif. And this is something the Vilna Gaon writes in Yerideya as well. The Vilna Gaon points out that we have, it's not really a chiddush of the Vilna Gaon, he just points out the psukim. We have the psukim in Sefer Melachim. So if anyone remembers Sefer Melachim, you have the Melech Ashur comes along and he threatens that he's going to destroy the Beis HaMikdash. Comes along Chizkiyahu HaMelech, he's kitzatz dalse ha'echel. He goes along and he cuts down the golden doors of the Echel and he gives them as a shigron, he sends them as a gift to the Melech Ashur. What are you sending them as a gift? What are you going defiling the Beis HaMikdash? Certainly, when you do such a thing, you cut down, it says, Lo sasim ken l'Hashem elokeichem, you're not allowed to do that, you're violating an issa d'oraisa. What right does he have? If Melech Ashur decides he wants to come along and destroy the Beis HaMikdash, that'll be his problem. How do you have the right to get involved, Chizkiyahu HaMelech? Says the Vilna Gaon in Yoredei, you see clearly from that story in Sefer Melachim that when you have an option of either the entire Beis HaMikdash being destroyed, even though I'm not going to be a part of it, I'm not doing anything, I'm sitting back in my house, I'm not getting involved at all, I'm letting the Melech Ashur go ahead and destroy the Beis HaMikdash on his own time. It's nothing to do with me. Or I have option B, which is to cut down the walls of the Heichal and send them as a gift, even though I'm going to violate, Bekum Va'asei, actively I'm going to violate the Aveh of Lo Sasim Kein L'Hashem Elokeichem, you're not allowed to destroy Beis HaMikdash or Beis HaKnesses. I would rather violate an Aveh or Bekum Va'asei, because if you look at the overall perspective, I'm saving the Jewish people from a terrible destruction. And that was the cheshbon, that was the calculation that was made by Chizkiyahu Melech Yisrael at the time, and that was the correct calculation. The Gemara says he was Nisbarech because he did that. He made the right calculation because he was thinking very clearly about what the overall perspective is going to bring about if he allows himself to violate this Aveira B'Yadayim, as opposed to allowing a terrible desecration happen B'Sheva Altasa. There is a psak of the Shulchan Aruch as well. Shulchan Aruch says we have an Isser Daraisa of Bizayon Sefer Torah. You're not allowed to be Mevaza Kisvei HaKodesh. You're not allowed to treat them in a disrespectful manner. So the Shulchan Aruch writes in Yerodeya in Hilchos Sefer Torah, what if a person is traveling? And we're not talking about nowadays when you travel in a bus or in a plane where you can put the Sefer Torah in a respectful place. Talking about they used to travel on donkeys, on camels, whatever it was. Where are you going to put the Sefer Torah? You need to have a Sefer Torah for the minyan wherever you're going to go. What are you going to do with it? So the Gemara says, and this is quoted in Shulchan Aruch, that you're concerned that people are going to stop you along the way, they're going to steal the Sefer Torah, not just steal it, but we're afraid that they're going to desecrate the Sefer Torah, a bunch of Nachrim are going to steal it, they're not going to treat it respectfully. So the Gemara says, therefore you're allowed to sit on the Sefer Torah while you're traveling on the camel, in order that it shouldn't bring about a greater Bizayon, if you're going to put it in the satchel, and someone's going to come along later and steal it, and then be Mevazit, so you're allowed to sit on it B'Yadayim now as you're traveling. So the Acharonim ask, what right do you have to sit on it that's violating an Aveir? B'Kum Va'aseh, you're actively violating the Yisra B'Zayin Sefer Torah, you have a right to do that? And the answer to that is yes, you have a right to do that, because you have to look at the overall perspective. What is the outcome going to be? If I leave things the way they are, and I put the Sefer Torah in the nicer place that it should be, in the suitcase or whatever it is, that is opening up the Sefer Torah to be desecrated later on, a much worse violation of B'Zayin Sefer Torah than if I, B'Yadayim, go ahead and violate an Aveira of sitting on the Sefer Torah and being Mevazit. This is unfortunately a Shaila that came up in all the generations when we had pogroms. So the Shvus Yaakov talks about, let's say, is a person allowed to go ahead if they know that the shul is about to be vandalized, are they allowed to go ahead and actually burn a Sefer Torah on their own in order that they shouldn't come later on, the Nachrim shouldn't come later on, and make a much worse destruction than the way we would take care of it. So am I allowed to go ahead and destroy them in order that they shouldn't be destroyed with a greater B'Zayin later? This was a great, great suffix that was discussed in all the Gedolei Acharonim throughout all the generations. The Chazon Ish writes as well, he weighs in on that issue, that you do have a right to do that. Unfortunately, it's a shaila that's really been asked. But he says you do have a right to do that, to save the Sefer Torah from a far worse B'Zayin that can come about later on. You have a right to go ahead and burn them. I remember when I was in the White Shul, what? No, so obviously it has to be a real probability that something's going to go wrong. Yeah, talking about when you know it's going to happen. I remember in the White Shul, there was someone, I don't remember his name anymore, but there was someone in the White Shul who, every time he did psicha, I mean, I never noticed, but he told me every time he did psicha, he starts to cry. I said, so he once pulled me over by Shabbos Mincha, and he told me, so you ever noticed that I'm crying? So I didn't really know what to say. So he says, well, I want you to know, every time we open the Aron Kodesh on Shabbos, I cry. They said to him, why are you crying? He said that he was in, before the Holocaust, he was in Europe, and he was in some shtetl, I don't know where it was, and he said that the Rav of the town knew that the city was about to be destroyed and the shuls were about to be desecrated, and the Rav of the town came over to him and his brother one night, and he told them, I want you to take all the crowns of the Sefer Torah, and I want you to take all the beautiful crowns that we have, the silver and the gold, and melt them into the ground, because I don't want that the enemies should later on desecrate them and use them for other things. The parchment, the Rav assumed, what are they going to do with the parchment? They have nothing to do with it, they're just going to leave it. It's a strange assumption. But the silver and the gold, they're for sure going to take and use it for improper purposes, and they're going to be mevaza all of that which is sitting on top of the Sefer Torah. So he told them that night, before the Nazis were about to invade the city, he told them, He wants them to sit there the whole night and melt the beautiful Kisri HaTorah into the ground. And said, ever since that day, he hasn't been able to be forgiving of himself for doing such a thing. He felt that he violated such a Kavod HaTorah. He violated it. He should have allowed it to stay in the Aron Kodesh by itself. So I remember I told my father, so he told me that every time they open the Aron on Shabbos, he has flashbacks from that horrible thing that he felt that he did, and he can't get over it. He feels that the Ribono Shel Olam will never forgive him for what he did. And my father pointed out to me that if that's what the Rav told him to do, he shouldn't be feeling uncomfortable about it. And Adarabba, this is the psak that we normally give, that if a person knows that there's going to be a far worse Bizayin HaTorah that's going to come about if you leave things as they are, so you should violate the Avera B'kum Vaaseh. Obviously, it's not going to calm a person's nerves down when they have such deep feelings of regret for something that they did, but still, it's something to consider. It's a shaila that's come up, unfortunately, all too often. Chasam Sofer has an issue also. Interesting shaila. Chasam Sofer has a shaila where he says they made a beautiful, I think he says it was a tas shel zav. I think he says it was a beautiful, plaque, a golden plaque that they planned to put on top of the entrance to the shul, which said, Zeh Hashar LaHashem Tzadikim Yavovo. That was going to go on the entrance of the shul, and some wealthy man in the community in Preshburg paid for it, that they were going to put it on the main shul, entering into the main sanctuary. And somebody, a wise guy, came the night before they affixed it on the shul, and he went and he glued it with crazy glue onto the entrance to the bathroom. And now they had the Shem Hashem was emblazoned into the bathroom, and they didn't know how to take it off. And they went to the Chasam Sofer to ask him how they should deal with this. What are they supposed to do? If they leave it like it is, it's a tremendous bizayon to the Shem Hashem. If they go ahead and they start scratching it out and they erase the Shem Hashem, that's an Isra Mechikas Hashem Daraisa. So how are you allowed to do that? B'kum Va'aseh. And the Chasam Sofer wrote in the Tshuva that he thought, although it would mean being Mechikas Hashem B'kum Va'aseh, even though it would mean violating the Avera on our own, he said, obviously it's better to get a non-Jew to do it, but if you can't find one, if that person is not around, then we should go ahead as soon as possible and erase the Shem Hashem on our own, because it's going to be such a bizayon for the Shem Hashem to be left there in such a state, and therefore it would dictate that we have a right to violate even B'kum Va'aseh, although if you left things the way they were, the bizayon would only be B'shev Va'al Taseh. Yeah? I think there's a very important application nowadays. So you'll say, Baruch Hashem, we live in a time where we don't have these shailas about burning Sifrei Torah and melting the silver into the ground and all these kinds of things, or some wise guy who goes around and puts the Zeh Hashar LaHashem onto the bathroom. Usually we don't have these kind of scenarios. But although my father told me, you live long enough, you hear everything. So, I don't know, I hope, Shanizke. So there is a very common shaila that is very prevalent in our generation. It's an important shaila, and that is based on the Ramah. The Ramah gives a psak in Aruch Chaim that you have no right to give food to somebody who is a secular Jew because you're afraid that they're not going to make a bracha. Not you're afraid, you know they're not going to make a bracha, they don't know how to make a bracha, and you know that they're not interested in making a bracha. So that's going to be an active violation of Lifnei Iver Lo Sitei Michshol. So you're not allowed to offer them any food. So Rabbi Shlomo Zalman Auerbach once had a dilemma because he was having a Chanukas Habayis in Kol Torah, that was his yeshiva in Bayit Begun. So there was a building that was dedicated by a family that was a secular Jewish family, and they came. It was a sweltering hot day in the middle of the summer, and they came for the big dedication, and they didn't know what to do because, on the one hand, the Ramah says you're not allowed to offer them a drink, you're not allowed to offer them any food because they're not going to make a bracha. On the other hand, how can you not offer somebody a drink when it's boiling hot outside? What are you going to do? So Shlomo Zalman Auerbach went ahead, and he gave them the water, and he gave them to drink, and he took care of them. And all the Talmidim later on gave him a whole headache. How is he allowed to do that? Don't you know that the Ramah says you're not allowed to? So he writes as follows in the Tshuvas Mincha Shlomo. It's a very important Tshuva because, number one, it shows how sensitive Reb Shlomo Zalman was to those who were secular Jews. And it shows you what a God of Israel, how they think. You know, I remember on Reb Shlomo Zalman's yard site one time, I used to go to Rav Asher Weiss's shir every week on Tuesday night in Bayit Vegan. So I was learning in the Mir, so I had to get back to the Mir. I used to take the bus, but he had a driver who used to drive him back to Ramot. They used to drive me afterward to the Mir. So he would drop him off in Ramot, then they would drive me back. So it was a very interesting car ride every week because that driver was Rabbi Lau's younger son. His name was Tzviki Lau. So he had a lot of stories from his father. I had a lot of stories from my father, and Rav Asher had a lot of stories from himself. So it was just always a very interesting car ride. So I remember one week, it was Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach's yard site. I don't know if it was that night or that week. So we were talking about different stories about Rav Shlomo Zalman. So he said, Tzviki Laus had a story from his father that was very interesting. He said that his father told him, Rabbi Yisrael Meir Lau told him, that there was somebody in the Knesset Parish, the old Menachem Parish. So now his son is in the Knesset, but Menachem Parish was the older, the first one from the Aguda who got involved in the Knesset, I think, if I'm not mistaken. So he apparently was fighting for who knows how long that they should have a certain area on Yerushalayim closed off, that they shouldn't have traffic passing through there. He was bothering the mayor of Yerushalayim, that they should have a certain area sectioned off and they shouldn't have cars allowed to go through there. Anyway, he was fighting back and forth for so long. Finally, the mayor calls him up one day. He says, okay, we made the plan, we got the map, everything's ready to go. Can you come and sign off on it? We're ready to have whatever you wanted. So he shows him the map and whatever, he's all happy. And he says, one second, before I sign it, I have to go speak to Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach. So he says to him, now you're going to talk to Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach? What are you going to talk to Rav Shlomo Zalman? Finally, we're fighting for months and months, and now that we're ready to sign off on it, you say you're not ready yet? He says, no, I got to go get the haskama of Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach. So he takes the map with him, he runs to Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach's house, he asks him, what does he think? Now, Menachem Parish thought he was, or, right, Menachem was the father? Menachem Parish thought that Rav Shlomo Zalman was going to tell him, no, you didn't close off enough streets. What do you mean? Don't give in to this yet. You have to wait until they're ready to give in to close off all the streets in Yerushalayim. It's not good enough. So he wanted to blame the whole thing on Rav Shlomo Zalman to say, no, I can't sign it because it's not good enough. Shows up in Rav Shlomo Zalman and Arabach's house, and Rav Shlomo Zalman started to get upset at him. He said, what right do you have to close these streets at all? He said, what do you mean? Don't you know it's killing the Shabbos? All the kids are going to see the cars driving. He says, now when a secular Jew wants to drive through to get to his house, now he's going to have to make a detour and drive more on Shabbos because of you. Because now you closed off all the streets, so you're making him be Mechal Shabbos more. What right do you have to do that? Just because you want to keep Shabbos means he should be Mechal Shabbos more? So that's the perspective of a Gadol B'Yisrael. That's what Menachem Parish told Rabbi Lau, that from that he learned, we could be a Kanoi all we want, we can have all the calculations in the world, but I never would have thought, he says, I never would have thought of that calculation, because what do I care? The secular Jew is the secular Jew. But the Gadol B'Yisrael has the obligation to think about everybody. You can't just say, we live in a narrow little world and that's all we care about and everybody else is forget about them. No, you have to take everybody into consideration to figure out what's the Bechira, the Mi'ad Hara, what's the way to figure out, to estimate, what is the lesser of all the evils involved, and that's what Shlomo Zalman said in that scenario. He felt it was inappropriate to close the streets because there are so many secular Jews that have to pass through this main thoroughfare, and by closing that street, you're going to have to make them detour and go be Mechal Shabbos even more. Either way, over here, Shlomo Zalman Auerbach writes so beautifully in the Mincha Shlomo that when he talks about this case that he had about the secular Jews who came to the building and he wanted to offer them food and he violated the Pesach of the Ramah, he said as follows, Harez Adama Lemisha Kotea Etzbo Miraglo Shel Chaveiro. Let's say you have somebody who has cancer in one of their toes. So the doctor comes along and he says, I have to amputate one of the toes, otherwise your whole body's going to be infected. Otherwise the tumor's going to spread to every other part of your body. I don't know if that's a good example, but something of that nature. So he says, that doctor, Poshodeno Mikro Mazik, what are you going to call him? Oh, look at that guy, he's a murderer, look at what he do, he cut off his toe. You're a fool if you say such a thing. That can't be your perspective. Elam Asakin. There's no greater tzaddik than that doctor. Look what he just did. He saved a man's life. Ah, you have to cut off a toe. Okay, but you have to cut off a toe to save the entire body. Otherwise, the whole body would have been infected. And he says, Kach gam kan. Eino chashev kim machshil. You don't call this person a machshil. You don't say, oh, you're giving a secular Jew something to eat or drink without making a bracha. Oh, you're being lefnei evil osita michshil. What do you mean? By offering him the drink, imagine, I have a secular Jew comes to my house. It's a sweltering hot today. I'm assuming they didn't even have air conditioning. It's boiling hot, and you don't offer him a drink. Imagine what he's going to say. Oh, I hate these religious people. He's going to violate a far worse avera than this halach of not making a bracha. And therefore, Shlomo Zalman Auerbach says, if you have the wrong perspective, if you choose not to give him a drink, adarabah, you're having someone... That's like leaving the toe of the person who has an infection, of leaving the person who has a cancerous limb, you leave it on them because you say, I can't bring myself to amputate, I can't bring myself to take away from the beautiful body that God created. You're a fool if you have such a perspective. That's the wrong attitude to have. Again, Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach and all the other Gedolei Achronim teach us that when you have a halachic dilemma, the answer is not always sheva al tasa. The answer is you have to figure out how to take all the factors into consideration and figure out what is the way to be Bocher B'Mi'at Harab? But the starting point of all of that discussion is from our Gemara. Our Gemara says here, when you have the halachic dilemma of how many times should I sprinkle the blood on the Mizbeach? Should it be one? Should it be four? I don't know which way is right, which way is wrong. The answer is not simple. The answer is not, oh, well, Sheva al Tasa, just leave everything the way it is and don't sprinkle at all. Or leave everything the way it is and just sprinkle once. No, the Gemara has a possibility that maybe you should sprinkle it four times, even though that means violating an Aveira, the Kumba say, violating Baal Tosef, because, who knows, maybe that's the lesser of the two evils when you cite the whole situation that's in front of us. Okay? Next week, we will continue.